refining your ideas based on the feedback you get from the whole group. And because we're starting late, we may have to kind of adjust our schedule a little bit as we go. But that's the idea for the whole day. So I wanted to start off today by just asking again, how many people had a chance to look at the handout that was sent out yesterday morning about our project? A few people. Okay, so those people who saw the handout, you have a kind of a better sense than probably everybody else will, because there's a lot of data in that handout. So you're kind of the experts within your groups. You can help everybody out if they want more information. If you haven't had a chance to look at it, please do look at it. I'll also make these slides available to everybody after this workshop, so you don't feel like you have to take notes on everything or remember everything I say. So I wanted first just to get a sense of who we have in the room on a really broad level. So how many people in the room, and you can raise your hand multiple times, how many people in the room consider themselves to be academic researchers? And look around and see who your colleagues are. And how many people in the room consider themselves to work with community-based programs? Okay, so I see a lot of overlap, and that's great. How many people are language teachers? How many people teach endangered languages? Okay. And then how many people work more on the administrative side of things than in the research or content delivery? A few people do administration. Great. That's great to see here, because I think that's a group that gets left out a lot in these conversations, and they have a huge role in supporting and guiding the work that gets done. So just to let you know, I'm not going to talk about every single thing in the PowerPoint, but if you do have burning questions about something I don't go into in detail, please let me know. If I move too far away from the mic and you can't hear me, let me know. Let me know if anything comes up that impedes your understanding. Okay, so a background is that endangered language documentation, we know, can provide critical resources to support language reclamation and revitalization, which we will abbreviate as LR through most of this presentation. However, as Alice talked about in her plenary, which was a great introduction to this workshop, there are many questions about these benefits of language revitalization and how and she didn't really go into this, but she touched on it in brief, but there are also a lot of questions about how language documentation specifically benefits language revitalization and reclamation and how these practices impact especially young children in their communities. And that is the crux of our workshop and our interest. So we're really interested in looking at children, especially ages 0 to 5, to see how language documentation and the uses to which language documentation is put for revitalization impact young children, both linguistically and otherwise, in their communities. So we had an NSF grant, for which we are extremely grateful, which supported us in exploring these questions. And so some of the big questions we had were how, why, and to what extent does documentation benefit revitalization efforts? What are the methods for identifying and evaluating those benefits? And how can we achieve better cohesion once we know what those benefits are between how we do documentation and what our language revitalization goals are? So another big question that we came to this with is how does child language acquisition differ in endangerment and revitalization situations? If we're looking at how children benefit from documentation revitalization, we really need to know what happens with children in language learning in both the social context of language endangerment, but also the kind of typologically different kinds of languages that often are faced with endangerment. We also think that understanding these differences will help us optimize language learning in these environments, but also help us understand some linguistic questions about how languages change and how language shift happens in endangerment contexts, both now and throughout history. Our third big question, and this is the one that Alice talked about most, is what are the benefits of language revitalization? And what has often been talked about until But we also think that there are lots of questions about how language work benefits both children and their communities in other ways. And this includes fluency, number of speakers, but also mental and physical health, sense of cultural identity, academic performance, leadership skills, family and community connections. So we started off with this basic belief that a cross-disciplinary perspective is critical to improving practices within the field of documentary linguistics and to ensuring maximum benefit of documentation in the field of linguistics and in broader society, and that this interdisciplinary perspective was kind of the most important first step we needed to take in addressing these questions. And so we used our NSF grant to hold a workshop in Washington, D.C. last October that brought together a really diverse group of people who had, most of whom had never interacted with each other or with each other's professions before in the area of language documentation revitalization, and but all of whose work really centered around very similar questions of how communities were being impacted by their work and how that work connected in some way to language. So we had four key topics to be explored during this workshop. Those were, what do we know about young learners in language revitalization? What's special? What's important to know about young learners? What do we not know? Documentation methods and products in support of language revitalization. So what kinds of practices in language documentation and what kind of products produced by the documentation benefit or impact positively or negatively children in these contexts? What are the linguistic outcomes and benefits? And what are the extra linguistic outcomes and benefits? And throughout all of this, we wanted to look at both what do we already know, what do we need to know, what do we need to do to address the gap between what we know and what we need to know, and then what kinds of specific recommendations and barriers can we make, can we identify or make for these, to identify those gaps. So first I wanted to just briefly tell you who we are. So we're a network of researchers, practitioners, representing a wide variety of fields, including public health, psychiatry, psychology, indigenous studies, education. We had a group of four organizers, of which I am one. We had some research assistants at UC Berkeley, and we had group members from all over the US, a few from Canada, one from Europe. We had people who work mostly in North America, but we had a few who work in Asia or Latin America. And this is just a picture of who we are. So I'm going to share some of our findings that we came up with during this workshop. Right after the workshop, we invited members of federal agencies, representatives of funders of language revitalization and documentation and kind of allied fields, and some researchers from the DC area where we held our workshop to come, and we presented them with our initial findings right like an hour after we had come up with them. And we got their input based on that. We also decided at that meeting that we needed to continue this work by transforming into a permanent body and continuing to work together, so we considered this a first step. And we also began preparing a white paper of our findings and recommendations, which is in the final editing process right now and will be shared probably in the next month or two. And I'll make sure that everybody in this room has is emailed a link to that. Some of the general issues that we came up with in our, that we identified during the workshop was that a deficit model predominates throughout all of this work. So people tend to approach these issues of language endangerment and revitalization through the lens of loss and lack. And I think that Alice's comment about how we think of semi-speakers was a really good example of a deficit model. So she said, you know, we often think So looking at the kind of the lack of skill or use that they put the language to. But you can look at those people. One term I've heard quite a bit is language rememberer. So that's looking at what they do have as a language skill that they can build on. And then she used the term super learner. So really looking at them as these very skilled learners instead of these very impoverished speakers. And I think that this kind of paradigm shift of moving from deficit to strength model is something that we identified as something that needs to happen throughout all of our practices. We also found there's very little research on language revitalization for ages 0 to 5 in general. The research is scattered, not widely disseminated, and often difficult to find, and that we really need to build our interdisciplinary networks in order to effectively investigate these issues. There are a lot of institutional challenges that we also identified, so a lot of times this work is not honored or supported either financially or intellectually within the kind of institutions that we're in, especially if you're an academic researcher, this is often the case. There's also not a clear home for this work to happen. Like, does it belong in linguistics? Does it belong in indigenous studies? Where should it happen? And the lack of an institutional home can make it difficult to effectively share information because people don't know where to go to find it, or they don't know where necessarily to publish their findings. There are very few researchers who have the training and the focus within their work that is primarily on this work. And so just building the human capacity that we have to do more research by creating more people who have the training and have prioritized this work is really important. Again, revitalization, focused materials are not widely valued. And that if you're in an academic, often focusing primarily on revitalization carries a lot of risk actually for you. So our recommendations fall into a few categories. Improving the coordination, communication, and collaboration both within our professions or fields and across them, between researchers and practitioners, between us and funders. Really prioritize work on child development and language acquisition and language endangerment and revitalization. So make people, help people to do this kind of work, give them the tools that they need, the training they need, the funding and the infrastructure they need to do this work. Expand the scope of language documentation to address things that are needed for revitalization but are often not really prioritized in documentation. And to kind of enact a paradigm shift in general about how we think about endangerment and revitalization and children's role in it. So the coordination, communication, and collaboration, we really need to keep building these professional networks and creating spaces for people to interact with on a regular basis, both so they can share their knowledge with each other, but so they can also learn to talk to each other, because I think one of the issues that comes up is that we need to build a common foundation of understanding of the issues from our different perspectives in order to move forward in collaborative research. We need to really make sure that research and practice are integrated, so researchers are learning from what people are doing on the ground, and that research findings can be really immediately put into practice on the ground as well. And really prioritize projects that come out of communities, this both for ethical reasons and for practical reasons, that the research that comes out of community-generated ideas and concerns is often of higher quality than stuff that comes from the top, being researchers down into communities. Also really need to prioritize the research on child development. We need to look at how children are being exposed to language in both revitalization situations and in language endangerment situations and in indigenous communities where endangerment is not happening. So we need to understand how children and adults interact with each other in language, whether developmental trajectories for language development in children in revitalization context is different and how they're different, so that people who are doing this can know what to expect differently in different communities. And so, like, looking at how to measure and how to identify how children are employing their cognitive development in contexts aside from the ones we often look at when we're assessing language development. So we often look at school, or for older people, we look at work context and how their cognitive development is supporting their work there. But we need to, in these communities, think about community-focused contexts, such as cultural practices and ceremonies, and how cognition is interacting with those. And we always, when we do this work with children, we need to not separate them from their families and their communities, but understand that any benefits or challenges that they're experiencing are within the context of the larger community. We also really want to support more language documentation focused on children and on how language endangerment and language revitalization happens. So documentation not just of language itself, but documentation of language practices and language attitudes and language and documentation of revitalization practices and documentation practices, and how those both research and revitalization activities in communities are being are affecting people's language use and how they're affecting the products and the findings that we come out with. So some of the paradigm shifts, I mentioned a few of these before, but some of the paradigm shifts that we really want to focus on are developing protocols for documentation that incorporate all of these things that I've talked about so far, that really prioritize collaboration and taking community interests and priorities as a starting point for documentation. Also to take health and our understanding of what health is as something that communities determine. When we assess impacts and benefits, we also really need to make sure that we're not only considering what academic researchers consider impacts and benefits, but we're taking those definitions and those priorities for assessment from communities. And we really need to start building the status of revitalization within linguistics and within academia in general, in order to provide better support for the work that we're doing and to allow more people to enter into this field. So dissemination in next steps for our work. We had a poster at the LSA in January. We're developing a white paper, which I mentioned. The workshops we're having here at the ICLBC are a big point of dissemination for us. And we are also, as part of our work, developing a library, a virtual library of all the literature we found that we feel is relevant to this work. And this is research that's been suggested by all the members of our group, but also other people that we've talked to who said, oh, you should read this person's work, or things that sometimes even things we find in the popular press. And that is online, and when I send you this PDF, you will have a link to an Excel spreadsheet that has all of that literature. And if you see a gap there and you know some literature that you want us to add, please let us know and we'll include it. And then after, we're closing out our project now, and after this project, basically our plan is that members of our group will continue to have some sort of like regular meetings. They may not be the kind of workshop we had in October. We thought about having a conference where we invite people to present their own research related to this. We're also planning to do collaborative projects with each other, implementing some of the recommendations that we've come up with. And we're really hoping that this is just starting a conversation, and that other people will take this conversation in new directions. And that's basically what the rest of the workshop today is about. Is about you taking these ideas in directions that seem relevant for you. You can build on what we've talked about here. You can say, oh, there's a big gap, and this is what, you know, this is what really should be focused on. But that's the idea. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to
together a group of us to come together and talk about all these issues that she's gone over. And it was not only a great sharing, but it was kind of a bonding opportunity for people who don't get to talk to each other about their interests related to children. And we're hoping that you guys have that feeling when you leave here today, that there are other people doing similar things, facing similar challenges, people you can call on and look to for suggestions or ideas. A lot of times, because there's so little going on, people feel like, well, I don't know where to start, or I don't know how to solve this problem. So that's kind of what we want to work through today. So the first small group activity related to this, and you don't have to stay to the timeline exactly. If you cruise through a section and move on to another, that's fine. We're just hoping that you have this opportunity to work through some things that you're interested in, so related to something in the community. You also might want to talk about projects that perhaps didn't go as you had hoped the first time around, and maybe we can problem solve and give them a second chance. Other things you might be interested in, but you have no idea where to start, this is the place to kind of hash that out. So the first getting together will be, what's kind of going on? What would you like to add on or enhance or grow bigger? And we'll come back together and kind of share those things in terms of getting some ideas from other people, and you'll be like, oh man, I didn't think of that. And those are the kinds of things that came out of the DC conference was, wow, I'd be interested in this and this and this. And then finding out for the second group part is, okay, what does that involve? What are some of the steps I can think about taking? What are the problems I anticipate? And we can do some brainstorming and problem solving, because more than likely somebody in this room has faced that problem and dealt with it, or had to figure out how to deal with it, or had to get help with it. And even in Skype phone calls, we were talking about various problems we've been through. And I'd just like to share too, when I was doing my dissertation and I wanted to do this project, most of my committee had never heard of language revitalization, had never heard of second language documentation with children, and had no idea what any of this literature was. And so having this collection of literature is really wonderful to be able to say something is going on out in the field, and there are people doing it in different pockets. We just have to pull it together. So with that said, we'd like to encourage you to work with whomever you want, whether it's people you came with, or people who are doing something similar to you, or people you just like to meet. Small groups might be better, maybe 5 to 7, so everybody will have a chance to talk. And please take the time to introduce yourselves. We'll kind of wander around and get you started more with that. But like I said, the first part is sharing what's going on, what you're interested in, and what you might want to do next. And we'll take, what did we say, about 15 minutes to do that, and then come back to the group and give you a chance to share some ideas. And we'll kind of scribe those notes out so that we can have a collective sense of the group.
And we'll wander around during this process and answer questions.
And this is casual, so if you have questions, holler at us, or when, during the sharing, feel free to cross-talk with each other that we can share and get to know each other.
And you can move your chairs around if you wanted to go outside just to have a little bit of more space between groups. You can do that too. We'll come back to you.
So about 15 minutes. If you need to go longer, we'll... the meeting's already pushed, so we'll push if we need to. Okay. So.
Does anyone need help forming groups or just trying to your neighbor?
Yeah. No, no, I'm getting a link to our.
Oh, great, great, great. If I could just forward it to you.
Just forward me, I'll spell you my.
Okay, let me, I have to find it, let me just, yeah, here it is.
Okay. So N, yeah, N G. N B.
U B.
Yes. U M. At. Gmail.
So now you should have that link, and that should, that has a lot of.
It's a great idea.
One thing I've noticed is a lot of different
then we can think of what other literature might help you. We might incorporate some of those answers into the white paper, but also an opportunity for you guys to share what you're thinking about. And it's really interesting to me to hear some people are having the same issues. I hear a lot of, how can we bring the language to the home? How can we get the parents more involved? I'm hearing that from a lot of different people. And if anybody's had success with that, that would be awesome to share the magical answer. Because I was telling these guys, kids aren't dumb. If your parents aren't interested, it says something to them about the value of this school they're at. Oh, it's the place I get dropped off at. My parents aren't giving it at home. So that was just one topic that came up. So if we could go around the room and share maybe a couple of the ideas that came out that were interesting to you or you hadn't considered or something you really want to work on and that we could maybe help out with. Ruth and I have had many trials and tribulations and various successes and failures, and I can tell you about more failures if you want later, but you learn something from the failures in terms of, yeah, that didn't go the way I thought at all. But then you get feedback from parents or teachers about something that didn't go well. And some of my failures had nothing to do with me. They had to do with outside people coming into a community and thinking they could swoop in and do something. So assessing children's language in communities that are very insular and people coming in from the outside and assessing and then making statements about children's language being behind or poorly developed. And I would live in the community and then do the same assessments, and the kids are fine because they're willing to talk to me. Mm-hmm. And they were not willing to talk to the outsiders. And so there's just little things like that. If we can share those with each other, I thought would be good. So, volunteer?
Losing their language in the community, going to people who are documenting the language and saying, how can we save our language? What can you do for us to save our language? And there's funding issues you were mentioning, and there's motivation issues. For 0 to 5 year olds. I think by the time they go to preschool, they might actually have some resistance to language. Before that, they don't. Mm-hmm. But of course, once the kids get older, they blame the parents for not teaching them the language. So we just talked around a bunch of things. But I think our most important member is a person actually raised her kids in the language. Maybe you'd like to say a few additional words.
Hi, my name is Karen Baldwin, and I work for the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma Cultural Resource Office. And like Leanne said, we learned and raised our kids in the language all at the same time, which is very difficult. Our kids, our oldest is 27 now, so and our youngest is 17, so there's still some in the house. But anyway, we have a almost two-year-old granddaughter, and my gut still says to me to go home and be in my home with her on a very regular basis. You know, because the community is so dispersed that having a community-wide program isn't necessarily an option at this time. So, you know, my gut still is going back to the home and teaching it there.
right? What can we take from this Western model of education, which and which is both equal to ours, and then how will that, how what does it look like? How will that benefit our youth and our people to be strong, happy, healthy Inuit people? And so that's something that we're working on right now. And as an academic researcher, I struggle to be able to present and provide respectful research in our indigenous way. So basically, we're indigenizing the research and we're indigenizing the education model to fit our community. And it's been working in the North Slope, in the way high Arctic of Alaska, and we're bringing it slowly down to the South, which is where I'm from. I'm from the Bering Strait region. And so that's something that we're talking about. So the language nest will be 0 to 3 year olds, and then we want to just follow them up. And eventually, we don't want immersion schools anymore. We want to be able to be teaching education through our language rather than teaching about our language. So that's what we were kind of talking about too. And then there's a lot of research going on here. We have PhDs and master's and undergrad students here in our little circle. So.
And I think this is something important when somebody right there in the community can say to a researcher, here's what we're seeing and how can you help out, or how can you have that better vision? And you know, one of the bottom lines is that a good teacher knows the community, the audience, and the goals. And so taking a model that isn't necessarily appropriate for whatever you want to teach makes that learning process really difficult. So you know, you've made great strides and you had to go through the growing pains. But figuring that out, and I think that's true for most situations, it's just convincing other people that there is no one pedagogy, there is no one way of teaching. It's what's going to work within a community, within a particular classroom, or for a particular age. And so that's great that you made those strides.
Yeah, so we're working on decolonizing too a little bit, because it's so easy to just go back to what I was trained in, what I was, you know, and so that's another struggle too that we're going through. And then also recognizing and acknowledging historical traumas has been one big step forward for us to be able to heal from those wounds, so that our grandparents and parents won't feel like they're not welcomed at the schools, because that's kind of how they feel right now, and we want to make sure it's a community. And so that's a huge step forward that we're working on. And also acknowledging that things that are very holistic and interconnected, that's something too. We can't separate and compartmentalize things, and so we're trying to work towards that. And if there's research or articles or literature that would be helpful to understand ways to go in that direction of interconnectedness and convincing people that things are related, would be helpful for me. Thank
that's
you.
Great, and that's what I was telling Rue, that that's what I want. We hope it's okay that we're writing all this down, but we think this would be good to share with researchers out there wondering what would be good or interesting questions or helpful research areas that might be a literature that we haven't explored, but somebody might come across an article and go, ah, this will fit that. You have to, you know, recontextualize it, but those kinds of things can be helpful.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Other sharers, or I'm gonna start over.
So we were talking about a community in the Pacific Northwest. Do you want to say the name of the community? I don't want to mispronounce it.
Oh, we're from a Howisit First Nation.
Yeah. And so the concern there was, how do they start from the very beginning where they have relatively little revitalization efforts? It's very hard to know where to start. So there aren't a lot of fluent adult speakers. There are elders, but not that many. The generation below the elders understand, but they don't speak, right? The generation below that may understand much less, and kids, we think, understand even less, right? So it's hard to know where to start, and the idea was that you need to start with some sort of assessment to understand where everyone is in the community, and then connect with other communities that are a little bit in advance of where you are, and that seems like the only way to go, yeah.
Leanne has a wonderful article of how to teach when the teachers aren't fluent that has great suggestions on, you know, what it is you do. But one suggestion I would make is not to make everything linear. I think a lot of times we tend to linearize things. We've got to document before we can do something. We have to assess, which is important, but I don't think it needs to stop other things from also starting. know, reconfigured later. So I'd like to encourage you to start somewhere, and then if the assessment shows something different, you can modify that, but rather than waiting till that's entirely done.
I'd just add, I think another important thing when you're assessing is not just to assess what people do or what skills they have, but what they want.
Yes.
So it's so important when you're starting these programs to be really trying to move in a direction that people want to go in. And sometimes you need to have conversations about what the options are, you know, to so that if people haven't been thinking about this, they don't know where they could go. But it's really important to articulate that so that you can be working towards a common goal.
And not be limited by what you may not know. It's like, oh, we only want to do this. Karen can probably attest. I pushed Daryl and the group to do more. I think you guys can do more. We're doing so much. I think you can do more. Just a little pushy. But I think that's a good thing to keep in mind, is that we need to broaden our questions. We need to ask things differently. We need to not only assess what we can't do, but what those potential goals are, what things are able to be produced, but also value what people understand. That receptiveness, I think it's undervalued a lot of times, and it's an opportunity, because people who have that receptive understanding then can move on forward. They don't need to think of themselves as non-speakers so much as, I have another step to go and I have something to offer. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And also, one other thing is, so when you're discussing in your community about where people want to go, I think it's important also to discuss why. Like, why are people doing this? What is motivating people to have these goals?
And that really helps later on when things get stuck or people get hung up. The reminder of where they wanted to go and why can be revisited, but it also can be a motivator in terms of, remember about 2 months ago we thought we wanted to do this, it's getting hard now, but what are those steps? And that's that second part, is looking at those steps, which we may or may not get to today. You might want to continue on your own, but just keeping in front of people why they valued it 2 months ago can help people move forward. Yes, that is still true. We want to do that. Thank you.
So we were starting to talk just a little about the difference between how language documentarians approach language and how children 0 to 5 approach language, which is, you know, we sit there and try to get word by word representations of the language, but children don't read, and they're not, and, you know, say, okay, this is a bag, this is a telephone, is sort of a not really the way that children learn it. So how do we do documentation in a way that can get those 0 to 5 year olds so that they're sitting there and hearing the language, hearing people talk it, they're getting the sounds, they're getting the rhythm, they're getting the pattern. And so didn't have any particular answers, but thinking that that's much more of, you know, if we're trying to target children, that they have to be getting it from their grandmothers, and if their grandmothers or their fathers aren't speaking it, then it becomes a task of how to get it down in such a way that it can be, that they can grab it and reproduce it and start using the language on their own.
Basically, how can we put that opportunity and that input in front of them and then encourage output? One of my favorite stories about children and sound systems, I was sitting in a line for something, and there were a bunch of parents, and we're all waiting, and they've got a small kid, and the kid's kind of at the babbling stage, and everything that mom and dad said, the little kid imitated, and the mom's phone rang, and this kid precisely imitated the ring of the phone. You know, we don't realize how much they are taking in, so that's a great area that we need to think about, is how to have that input be impactful, but also provide them the opportunity to show what they can know and do. A lot of that's receptive with kids. I can't remember who I was talking to, but sometimes we forget that kids have a silent period, and it's okay. But some teachers tend to panic. This kid hasn't spoken for 2 months. That doesn't mean stuff's not going on up here. It doesn't mean that in a month they're not going to just suddenly start speaking in entire sentences. So a better understanding of where kids are and what they can do. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
in to breathe life into the language. We there is 192 languages in British Columbia alone, and in our case on Vancouver Island, we know that there's probably less than 100 speakers in our village, and less than 200 in his language group, Kwagyuk, and we're Nuchano, used to be called Nootka. But within our, we acknowledge, we talked about needing to acknowledge, setting aside the differences in dialect,
mm-hmm.
and needing to breathe language and breathe life into those languages, and set aside, just needing to acknowledge the barriers that exist in order to document the language, but also to create a work plan
mm-hmm.
and some of the curriculum and resources that can be easily shared. One example was a community in this, with this dialect, uses a different writing system than this community, so the resources can't be easily shared. In order to put a nice meal on the table, they can't enter, they can't be used together. And we also talked about documenting all the language and not simply only what the community thinks they need or want to use as researchers or people that are doing the curriculum or the documentation of the language. And with it, we spoke briefly about the technology that is available as a resource, whether it's something like the Rosetta Stone uses or a virtual museum. How can we incorporate that? Because that's the age of our children now, is technology.
Right.
We grew up with this. Anybody 35, 50 and older grew up using this to document things. But our kids are on this.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to acknowledge that and somehow bridge that gap.
Meet them where they are and see how we can use that to its best effort. And I think with dialect, sometimes we have issues of competition or which one do we use and things like that, and it should be much more broader of valuing all those dialects. And you know, I was trying to think of what you're saying, you can't share, but can you share and have like a 2-page book, or you know, I'm like 2 steps ahead in problem solving, but getting beyond the competition of the dialects to where the dialects are valued. One situation I was familiar with, the two classroom teachers spoke a little bit different dialect, and so it became kind of a game in that how many ways can you say this, and the kids would get both opportunities, and it was harder for the teachers than it was for the students. So the teachers really valued their dialect and the way they did it, and the kids are like, oh cool, I can say that 2 ways. And so sometimes it's less issues with the kids and more issues with the adults sharing.
One more item was to recognize the value of the music and song in being able to transfer that knowledge. Is that such a, the rhythmic of it
right.
can be
revitalization work or anything else. So kids go to boarding schools, like including myself. I went to boarding school where like you get pressures from your peers. If you speak the like your native language, they were like, oh, you're from like the mountains or things like that. So I definitely feel like maybe you've been through that. So this is like where I'm standing. So I don't really know kind of where to start.
That's a tough challenge. You know, kids are impacted by their peers. It's that strength of identity and the community valuing the language that is going to help with that. But those aren't small issues. Yeah.
Oh, you're fine. You're fine.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, that is very difficult because you go into a broader community where more powerful language is there, and that's the impact. And I think some of that comes back to broad valuation of languages. And it's going to be a slow process, but having that community and that family support for it is the place to start with that. But it's hard. Thank you for sharing that.
And I think you said valuing language. What I think is even valuing multilingualism,
yes. Yes.
Like that you can function in several languages at
right.
the same time.
Yes. Yeah.
Hi. One of the things we're doing is, starting at 2 and 3 year olds, I think you and I were part of an international study where linguists have field workers and we're gathering data on the way 2 and 3 year olds acquire the indigenous language in our community, which is Dene, an Athabascan language. We have the language nest in with our 3 year olds, we have pre-K and kindergarten. Grade 1, grade 2, grade 3, we have a Dene immersion program, fully staffed with certified teachers from the community. We also teach core Dene right up to grade 12. But one of the unique things that we're doing is we started our own TEP program, so we have the Dene Teacher Education Program.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if any of you guys have a similar situation, I would say we're one of the only buildings, and this is just in one building in one small First Nation in Saskatchewan, where students are learning the language from 3 year olds to the TEP program. So we have those TEP students right in our building,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to be working with experienced immersion teachers. So we're developing our own teachers the way we want them to be trained through First Nations University of Canada. So it's kind of a neat program. It's really neat to have those university students in the school. They're developing materials for teachers in the classrooms already as part of their program,
mm-hmm.
part of their projects for different classes. But out of 3,500 people that live in the community, 2,700 still speak the language, so we're a little bit of a different, we have a stronger language base.
Awesome options there, but I like that idea of the teacher training. I think that's one place we tend to go back to, that idea of, well, this is how I learned and this is how to train. Language teaching in general is not the best field in terms of how it should be done. There's lots of different ideas. Americans in general are terrible at it. I mean, surely, right? So many people have language classes they take in school, and then if they go on to become language teachers, they just repeat that same way. But if you have this opportunity to have students learning and learning to be teachers in that same environment, that's an awesome opportunity.
But one of the key challenges, and that's what we're hearing a lot of the immersion programming, is the lack of resources.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the work plan would be that resource, a concentrated idea of resource development, so that you don't have teachers in the same case when the immersion program started up, where they are creating it one day ahead of teaching it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to develop through
those are hard long-term questions, but definitely helping out with teachers scrambling at the last minute, oh, I need something for today, yeah, that's not the best. It works out, but it's not the best in terms of a broad perspective. Should we let everybody else off the hook, give you a little bit more time left? So the idea was to be able to share today, if you look at the back of the form, it's what would you really, if you had to pick your, this would be awesome if in 2 years I could come back here and share something I've done. What is something you would like to do, would like to work on, would like to get help with? What are the steps in it, and what are some of the problems you anticipate with it? Just to get some of this down on paper in terms of pushing yourself forward is what we'd like to encourage. Sometimes it's just coming up with the idea and then figuring out who you need to talk to. So it looks like we have 15 minutes left, is that right?
Yes.
So.
Oh, no, 10.
10. Oh, you can do it faster than me.
you can work through lunch if you want to.
But the idea is that we knew we wouldn't finish today. We just wanted to give you a chance to think about what is something I would really like to help my community do, or something I would like to research. I've seen a couple projects where somebody was doing their master's or dissertation research, but the add-on project actually became more impactful to them and their communities because they had a chance to see that's academic and not necessarily as helpful to a community and small children, but this other thing I can combine with it becomes more important. So we'd like to give you that 10 minutes to try and think of the project you'd like to do and what might be the steps you'd take next that maybe when you return home next week you can start those steps. And please do holler back if you have questions. If we can't help you, we can